Hello and welcome to episode 387 of the UK True Crime Podcast. I'm Adam. Thank you so much for joining me. Sorry I'm a day late this week. Life kind of got in the way. Today we look at a fascination with the occult, a brutal murder, mistaken identity, and lingering suspicion of whether justice has actually been served. But first, let's set the context for today's story with our Guess the Month and Year game. Number one in the UK was Yaz even, and the Plastic Population with The Only Way Is Up. In the US, the late great George Michael was in the top spot with Monkey. And in Australia, the fifth top selling single of this year was Kylie, I Should Be So Lucky. In the news this month, 70 people were killed in a crash of three Italian Air Force fighters at an air show in Germany. Ian Rush became the most expensive player to join a British club when he returned to Liverpool for £2,700,000 after a year at Juventus in Italy. Everyone's favourite royal, Prince Andrew, and his wife named their daughter Beatrice Elizabeth Mary. And also this month, just to make you feel old, boxer Tyson Fury was born. Films released this month include The Last Temptation of Christ and the intellectual classic, The Blob. So did you get the month and year? It was August 1988. Of course it was. Today's story comes from Hessel, which is a small town of around 15,000 people, 5 miles west of Hull, on the northeast coast of England, and it's where the Humber Bridge crosses the estuary. You may recall it hit the news in 2007 with the floods. Do you remember that torrential rain hit the northeast of England and 100 millimetres of rain fell in just a few hours? There were deaths caused by this, including one man who drowned in Hessel. We join the story in August 1988. Age 33, life was good for Keith Slater. He was doing okay as a self-employed driving instructor, and he was also a keen rugby player for local team Hessel, enjoying the game and the social side too. Keith was married to Carol and they lived with their children in a two-bedroom terraced house in Bon Accord Road. It was a Friday night before the late August bank holiday. Keith and Carol's children were due to go that evening for a sleepover with the grandparents, and so by midnight Keith and Carol were sleeping soundly. It had been a good day for the family. Earlier they'd been to a nearby wooded area by a lake called Little Switzerland for a picnic, while Keith's car was being repaired. After lunch, he picked up his car and called into the driving school where he'd been franchised for the last 16 months or so. At about 8:30 p.m, he picked up his wife Carol from her part-time job at Homebase before they headed home to have a quiet night and dinner. After the food, they watched a bit of TV, with Carol heading up to bed about 10:30, followed by Keith an hour later. It was shortly after midnight that Keith was woken by a loud knock at the front door. Like many of us, Keith initially tried to ignore the noise, assuming it was just maybe kids messing about. But as the knocking continued, Carol, who was also awake, decided that Keith should pop down and see who was at the door in case it was related to their two children. She feared it could be the police and there'd maybe been some sort of accident. Keith put on some clothes and went down the stairs, noticing outline of what seemed to be a man standing on their doorstep, and it wasn't someone he immediately recognised. Carol too looked out of the bedroom window to try to see who was at the door, but she could only make out their back as he was standing so close to the front door. As the door opened, she heard a male voice call out in a loud and quite aggressive voice, "Keith Slater." Then there was the unmistakable sounds of a scuffle on the front doorstep. It seemed as though Keith and the visitor were fighting. Barely able to comprehend what she was seeing, Carol raced down the stairs to see Keith in some sort of a headlock being attacked by a large man dressed in all dark clothing. Carol tried to attack the man to get him to release Keith, and seconds later the scuffle was over as the mystery man took to his heels and ran down the road with a blood-stained knife clutched in his right hand. As Carol tended to Keith, she could immediately see he was seriously hurt as she moved his body to the sofa. It was only here that she could really appreciate the sheer extent of his injuries, as he had suffered knife wounds to the neck, which were pouring with blood, choking Keith and causing him to struggle for breath. Carol was hysterical, waking her neighbours as she was screaming, "Don't let him die, don't let him die." The emergency services were soon on the scene, but despite all their efforts, Keith's injuries were too severe, and he died shortly afterwards in Carol's arms. It was later found he'd been stabbed in the throat, severing his carotid artery and jugular vein. Keith Slater was just 33 when he died. A seemingly popular man with no secret life and no enemies. Just who would have wanted to kill him? A murder inquiry was launched and a major incident room was set up at Hessel Police Station. Officers appealed for relatives or friends of the killer to give himself up. They said that someone must have known who was responsible. As if it was a local man, he'd have got home sometime after 12:30 a.m. covered in blood. It didn't feel like a random attack by a stranger, especially as Carol heard the man mention Keith's name on the doorstep. So as well as the door-to-door inquiries, police interviewed all of Keith's pals at the rugby club, as well as players from opposing teams in case an incident from a recent game had just got out of hand. They spoke to all his current and past pupils at the driving school, but everyone was saying the same thing. Keith was a great guy, and they'd no idea why anyone would want to hurt him. There had been no direct witnesses to the attack except Carol, but one man certainly interested police. A local 17-year-old had been to the pub that night and walked back to his house close to Keith's home at about the same time that Keith was murdered. A photo fit was produced that looked just like him, and the man contacted the police. His sister was a policewoman, but he denied any involvement. In October 1988, 6 weeks after the murder, this man was shown on the Crime Watch reconstruction, and police clearly saw him still as a viable suspect. There were also two women featured in the reconstruction. One was a young, stunning blonde-haired woman who'd been seen with Keith in a number of pubs over recent weeks. Another had been driving his car with Keith the day before the murder, when Keith wasn't scheduled to have any driving lessons. Had Keith been having an affair or affairs? And could the man who attacked him have been a jealous boyfriend or husband? But the main focus of the inquiry was another man who featured strongly in the Crime Watch reconstruction. A burly man in dark clothing who asked for directions just after midnight to Bonacore Road. Was this the man they were looking for? The man was also seen running away from the scene, taking a quite unusual non-direct route, perhaps suggesting that it wasn't a local man, as had been first thought. This man was seen crossing Ferry Road Bridge, and this is where detectives later found a bloody tissue. Had this been dropped by the potential suspect? It was found it had Keith Slater's blood on it, so surely this was the man responsible for the murder. The problem is, back in those days, 1988, the DNA was nowhere near the level it is now. There was also one other clue which seemed to be of significance to the case. A workman responsible for looking after a house close to the murder scene had discovered a box of discarded matches with numbers written on both sides. For people who understand these things, the numbers 268-11988 were believed to be ritually satanic and of significance. But detectives, they were quite unsure how any of these pieces fitted together. Despite taking more than 1,600 witness statements, detectives were unable to secure the key lead that they were looking for. And they couldn't find the murder weapon, thought to be a knife of a 5 or 6 inch blade. So with the Crime Watch reconstruction, detectives hoped that this could provide them with some concrete information to pursue. Remember, this is before Crime Watch messed around with all the presentation. It was super, super popular back in 1988, as you might well remember. Now, in Wallington in Surrey, 200 miles away, a woman was watching Crime Watch that night, and she couldn't wait to tell her son, Barry Williams, just what she'd seen about Keith's murder. And when Barry heard that Keith Slater had been murdered, he immediately went to the local police station, saying he wanted to talk to them about the murder. He was a pub landlord and he'd been renting rooms in his house in Surrey to two brothers, Martin and Patrick Brown. They'd been heard discussing the evil man Slater, sometimes referring to him as an evil spirit. They were obsessed with him. If anything went wrong in the house or was broken, the brothers would say it was Slater's fault. The two men were often visited by a man called Joe Henry, and the three of them would disappear off into the woods with him to perform all sorts of rituals. Henry was described by Barry Williams as a very strong character, very into shamanism, and someone who Barry felt lived in a different world. Along with the Browns, he's obsessed with black magic and the occult. And Patrick Brown had also once lived in Willoughby, close to Hessel, which is where he met Joe Henry. But now with the name Joe Henry, detectives suddenly had a concrete link to the murder of Keith. Carol Slater had told the police that her marriage to Keith had hit a rough patch the year before in 1987, and at this stage she'd had an affair with Joe Henry when both worked at a care home. It lasted about 5 months. Keith found out and he was clearly seriously unhappy. Carol stayed with Keith and Keith warned Joe Henry to stay well away from his wife. Joe Henry was furious with Carol and with Keith too. Now, had this been enough to murder Keith? Or even ask one of the Brown brothers to do so? After all, Martin Brown matched the description of the man asking directions on the night of the murder, and he had a criminal record for assault and violence. All three men were arrested. Joe Henry and Patrick Brown had cast iron alibis the night of the murder. Martin Brown didn't. He said he'd gone to London to buy drugs for his brother. Then he'd gone to a pub, he got drunk and fell asleep in a park. But he couldn't provide anyone who saw him or was with him, and he'd no tickets to prove his travel. But while Joe Henry had a plausible reason, I guess, for wanting to hurt Keith, why would Martin Brown do this? He'd not even met him. But then detectives learnt that Martin Brown had told his deeply religious mum that he was in fact responsible for the murder. Deeply troubled by this information, she turned to the church and asked the priest for advice. This information then came to the police. Detectives hoped this would be enough to secure a conviction, but this line of evidence was not permitted in court, and to them, Martin Brown was not admitting anything. So despite being almost certain who had murdered Keith, detectives weren't able to prove it or detain Martin Brown. And as new priorities emerged and time went on, the investigation was scaled down. It was 15 years later, during a cold case review, that the significance of the discarded matchbox came to light. The numbers on the matchbox, 2681988, were believed to represent the date that Brown planned to murder Keith. The digits 18-1-1964 were in fact Brown's birth date. Now, I'm no expert in numerology, you won't be surprised to hear. But when the numbers of this date are all added together, it comes to 31, or 3 plus 1, which equals 4. That number 4 in numerology represents someone who is strong and able to do great things in life. Again, to you or me, this might be dismissed as a bit of entertainment, like many feel about star signs or how people write. But to Brown, he saw huge significance in numerology. And experts have suggested that this gave him the feeling of power from the occult, this number 4, and it would have inspired a feeling that he could do whatever he wanted and not be caught. He was almost compelled to carry out the crime. The other number, 32, which had been written on the other side of the box, is a bit easier to explain. It was the number of his intended victim's house. And the number 6 apparently signifies that whatever he did, so the killing in this case, would be easy for him to carry out. Detectives turned back to the tissue discarded on the night of the murder. At the time of the killing, forensic scientists from the bloodstained tissue could only identify blood groups and a partial DNA profile. But modern advances in forensic techniques, especially low-copy DNA, led to them establishing a full DNA profile for Keith Slater and also one other male. Detectives now just had to confirm that this DNA was that of Martin Brown, and they'd have their man. But when it was entered to the National DNA Database, there was no match to anybody on there. Detectives wanted to compare the DNA to Chief Suspect Brown, of course, but there was a problem. Brown had relocated to Australia to start a new life. So detectives approached family members in the UK to see if they'll be prepared to submit DNA to allow a familial DNA approach to be carried out. The dad, Norman, was happy to help, and when the tests came back, they were startling. It showed that the DNA from the bloodstained tissue was a match to one of his four sons. Three were quickly eliminated, which left just one, the chief suspect, Martin Brown. The lead detective obtained Martin's phone number in Australia and called him out of the blue. You can find the call online, and the surprise for Martin Brown is interesting to hear. Not surprising really, as I guess he must have thought all of this had gone away. But it hadn't. He didn't agree to provide a DNA profile. He didn't agree to come back to the UK to help the investigation. And he said he would think about being interviewed if detectives came out to Australia, but he certainly wasn't committing to anything. Wow, can you imagine how he must have felt after that call ended, bringing up the events of 18 years before? Detectives flew to South Australia to arrest Martin Brown. He was married with two teenage sons and working as a part-time electrician and part-time TV repairman. He lived in a pretty part of Australia near the mountains. Life was frankly good for Martin Brown before all that peace and family security was shattered by the knock on the door. He was extradited back to the UK, and in 2007, 42-year-old Martin Brown pleaded not guilty to murder, but he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison with no parole possible for at least 13 years after the trial at Sheffield Crown Court. Keith's family said in a statement, "Keith was a wonderful husband, father, brother and friend who will always be remembered and missed by everyone that knew him. We are glad that justice has been served at last and hope that we can now move forward with our lives." Then in 2012, Martin Brown made a startling confession from prison. First, he finally admitted that he did kill Keith Slater on the doorstep of his home in Hessel. This was 24 years after the murder. Brown told detectives he was responsible for delivering the fatal blow, but he insisted he was acting on behalf of others. Retired Chief Superintendent Colin Andrews, who was one of the first officers to arrive on the scene of the murder, said, "Brown has now confessed to the crime after being convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. Although he has admitted delivering the fatal blow, I am quite sure others were involved in planning the killing. That is the part of the matter that is unresolved." It was claimed that Brown had given police the name of the man he claims organised the killing and also gave him a knife to use. However, it is believed that lawyers at the CPS said there wasn't enough evidence to bring any charges. Andrew continued, "As things stand, there is not enough evidence to put anybody else for a court, but the investigation is ongoing and that is constantly under review." He said that a third man who no longer lives in the country is also suspected of being involved in the murder. He said, "There is insufficient evidence to extradite him. But should he step onto British soil, he'll be arrested and brought to us for questioning. He has been wanted since the conviction of Martin Brown, but we've not been able to get him back into the country." Okay, so I imagine the person that you're wondering about is Joe Henry. After the sentence, he was tracked down by the newspapers to Northumberland and asked for his thoughts. Henry, who has two children from a relationship after his affair with Carol Slater, said that he didn't even know anyone had been convicted of the murder. He said, "I didn't kill Keith Slater. I feel guilty, even though I've done nothing wrong, because I was having an affair with his wife." but the affair ended nearly a year before Keith was killed. I'd absolutely nothing to do with his death, and I certainly didn't encourage Mr. Brown to do it either. I was shocked when I found out it was him. Karen and I worked together. I only met Keith 2 or 3 times, but he seemed a nice bloke. I didn't have a problem with him. At the time of his death, I was living in London with a new girlfriend. I was totally stunned when the police turned up at my door. I thought it was some sort of routine check at first, but then I saw 15 police cars. I was completely shocked. Keith died 22 years ago. Although I've lived with the guilt of having an affair with his wife, I've not lived with guilt for any other reason. Carol and I looked after old people, that was our job and how we met, at a care home, and we had an affair for a few months. But we broke up amicably, and I moved away to London. He also claimed to have cooperated with detectives during all the hours of questioning that he'd undergone. So what do you make of what we've heard today? With all the criticism the police get, first thing let's make it clear, it was fantastic old-fashioned police work to solve the puzzle and ensure the right man went to prison. Although was it the right man, many have asked. It was certainly the man who committed the fatal knife attack, so I guess it was. Although it is easy to understand, isn't it, when people say that at least one other man surely should be in prison alongside him, don't you think? Either way, at least Brown is now in prison and has a long time to consider his actions. I didn't realise that numerology was such a big thing, did you? It's only in researching this case that I became aware of how for someone like Martin Brown, it was literally the most important thing in his life, the thing he lived his life by. He believed in it so much. Do you know much about it? I think I need to look into it more and cover more cases where rituals and beliefs are important to guiding people's actions. If you know any, please drop me a line. But really, today's story is all about Kathy and Keith Slater and their children. I feel really uncomfortable when I was reading about this case, with comments around the affair that Kathy had and the suggestions that Keith was having one too. People have affairs all over the place, and while I'm not saying it's right, this only came to light in this circumstance due to the murder. I really don't think it's fair for anyone, certainly not me, to judge them for how they chose to live their lives. It's up to them, all adults. In the end, what it boils down to is about how one man, a father, husband, and a great friend to many, was murdered in a cowardly attack related really to a man's anger about the ending of an affair. That's it, isn't it? And as a motive, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it? Affairs end, get over it. But while I can say that, the reality is that Keith's family have had to live their lives without him, which just isn't fair, is it? Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspects of UK True Crime, please head to Facebook and join well over 90,000 of us who talk UK True Crime 24/7. And to support the show, and why wouldn't you, please do head to patreon.com/UK True Crime for 75 full-length bonus episodes. Yep, 75. And there's a ton more exclusive content, including a chance to enter the competition for backstage tickets to my live show in the Northeast on the 2nd of June with Paul and Mike. It's going to be a great evening. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community. That's Shona Peterson, Michael Cartwright, Hayden Bushnell, Amy Drysdale, Tatio the Potato, and Terry Burke Wallen. Thank you all so much. Your support is just so much appreciated. That's patreon.com/UKTrueCrime. Please do come and join our community. So that's all for me for another week. I'm off to fall asleep nice and easily by listening to The Kings of Leon. I do recommend it for falling asleep, nothing else. So until we speak again next week, please do take it easy. And remember, despite all the others, stay classy. Cheerio for now.